programs all over the world start up, bloom, thrive, disappear. Behavior analysts go away, to stop being behavior analysts. And I thought, my mission is going to be to help behavior analysts grow and develop and stay alive and get bigger. So obviously I can't do this by myself, but if several people have this mission, or many people have this mission, I think it'll happen. So that was my mission. So my whole professional life has been organized around that mission. So my first approach to that is to behave strategically. If you have a mission, it's much easier to behave strategically, because there's this sort of overarching thing that you're never going to accomplish. It's not like you're ever going to accomplish it, but you have something to move toward all the time. So then that gives you an opportunity to behave strategically toward that mission. And some of the elements of behaving strategically for me have been to establish multiple paths toward accomplishing or reaching, or not exactly reaching because it's not a goal, but meeting that mission, getting to that mission. And so some of the paths that personally arose for me and that I have chosen to follow are: one is to create a department of behavior analysis with help from plenty of people. But that was part of the strategic approach to helping advance behavior analysis and to keep it alive, so that when Fort Skinner of the Desert died because of whatever reason, or something else died, there would be something else cropping up. So this is something else that was going to crop up. So with a lot of help, I have been working toward that, and we've accomplished that and are moving forward in that area. So that was one of the paths, was to train young people or older people, any age people, to be behavior analysts, to be really fine behavior analysts, to have a full curriculum in behavior analysis. Not one or two courses, not one or two courses in a practicum, but 10 courses in behavior analysis, 10 graduate courses. Imagine the luxury of it. A course in experimental, a course in theory and philosophy, a course in applied, a course in ethics, a course in, you name it, and there it is. So it was really important to me. So that was one of the paths. Another path was to develop my own research career. And I have two areas that I'm interested in. One is experimental work, and one is, which I've done not nearly as much as I would like to, because these other paths are taking a lot of precedence. But another personal agenda that I had was to start thinking I'm very interested in conceptual things and theoretical things, and it's always bothered me that behavior analysis hasn't been pulled together in some conceptual framework that is very systematic. It's been, certainly Skinner has done a lot for us in that regard, but there's a long way to go. And so I think, well, maybe I'll be one of the people that help work in this area. And so that was another of the paths that I chose to work in. And to be a mentor to women as well as men, as behavior analysts. And that's both within our department with the faculty that we have put together, with the students that we have, with ex-students and graduates that we have, with other people in the field who, for whatever reason, gravitate around in our area. I think I and most of the other people in the department have that approach to mentor. So those are some of the paths that I've taken. Now, this is a really important corollary to that, and that is follow only those paths consistent with your mission. Because what happens is you have your mission, you have some paths that you're going to take to the mission, but the problem is you get all these opportunities to do other things, especially if you have any competence, which I'm sure you all have. So as soon as you start doing things or do a few things well, people say, well, why don't you do this? Or why don't you do this? Or how about doing this? And there's a great tendency, I think a very strong tendency among women, to say yes. Okay, you need me? Okay. You need me? Okay. And there's that approach. Well, that's deadly if the needs that people have or what they want you to do is out of line with your mission. So it's okay to do that, in my view, if it's consistent with your mission. But if it's not consistent with your mission, it's very important to say no. No, I can't do that. No, I can't do that. No, I can't do that, which is very hard. Thank you very much. the next point in behaving strategically, sort of a general rule that I have, is to take advantage of unexpected opportunities. It's important to have goals. It's important to know where you're going. But very often, something will pop up that you never even thought of. It never occurred to you to do that. And all of a sudden, it pops up. Now, the question is it consistent with the mission? If it's consistent with the mission, Is it reasonable or possible to go down that path? And if it is, then do it. Go for it. You never thought of it before. It's not something you planned. You didn't sort of set it up or organize it or try to make it happen. It just happened. And this happens very often. I'll give you an example in my own case. Back in 1983, the University of North Texas had a master's degree program before the Texas State Coordinating Board, and the executive director of the Center for Behavioral Studies, which later became the Center for Behavior Analysis and then the Department of Behavior Analysis, died. The university withdrew the master's degree proposal. And we had already had four courses established in behavior analysis as service courses to the master's degree. I said to the dean, we've got to have those four courses. We've got to have those four courses, meaning the four undergraduate courses that had been established for the degree. And I thought, well, they pulled the master's degree requirement, so now they're going to just take away the courses. And then we won't have anything, so there won't be any little anything to kind of get toehold into this and to build this. So the dean, I kept saying to the dean, we got to have them. So one day I got a call from the associate dean of the graduate school, and he said, Sigrid, what are those four courses that you wanted? And so I named off the four undergraduate courses that had been previously okayed that I was afraid they were going to pull. And he said, let me call you back. So about 3 minutes later, I got another call, and he said, no, I didn't mean those four courses. I meant the four graduate courses. I said, oh, the four graduate courses. Oh, that one, two, three, four, those four. So we ended up with four graduate courses and four undergraduate courses, which truly gave us an opportunity to, because then we could have something called a Master of Science in Interdisciplinary Studies, and students could take their graduate courses, and that gave us entree into the master's program. 3 points. Create your own Walden II. Think of your life, think of your environment as a Walden II. Make your environment a Walden II. Make it the kind of place that everybody's behavior is reinforced and everybody's working toward the mission, whatever it is. Work with people you care about and care about people you work with. It's extremely important. It's probably one of the most important things you can do. It may be more important for women than men, or maybe just women are more aware of it than men. But it's very important to care about the people you work with and to work with people you care about. Next, analyze the contingencies that are operating in your life and the meta-contingencies that are operating. Because if you just look at the contingencies and not the meta-contingencies, you can get yourself in a box because you're not aware of... For example, let me give you a quick example. In the university, there are behavioral contingencies within the school that are moving people's behavior in this way and that and some other way. But if you're not aware of the meta-contingencies that are maintaining the system, the university system, you can get yourself in some pretty interesting situations. Because, for example, the meta-contingencies in the university push for semester credit hour generation. And so, but the faculty are told contingencies are do this, this, and this to get tenure or promotion or whatever. So what you have to do is you have to balance the meta-contingencies, which are really pushing on the contingencies that are being maintained by the people in the system. So a lot of times they'll say, this is important, but that's not really what's important because the meta-contingencies are pushing on something else. And the last thing, my last piece of advice is shape, 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 which means reinforce, reinforce, reinforce successive approximations because that's almost all you get. Thank you.
And next, Jen Sheldon. When Judy called me last October and asked me to be part of this panel, my first response was that I was very flattered to be part of such an illustrious group of women. My second response, which came very quickly, was that I didn't feel I had much information or any insight that would be particularly useful to anyone. But you all know how convincing Judy can be, so I agreed. Well, I pondered the topic for quite some time, and then I consulted my very best friend and colleague, my husband, Jim Sherman, and I said, I need to develop a talk for Ovid. And he said, well, what was the topic? And I said, how behavior analysis has helped me address some life challenge. Well, he thought for a moment, and then he suggested that I tell you how I used behavior analysis to shape him from, how should I say, Neanderthal-like, rat-like, antisocial, You could remember. How I shaped him into a devoted, loving husband, one who does all the grocery shopping, cooking, takes care of the children, the yard, does most house repairs, and says, yes, ma'am, when requested to do other tasks, and even buys me jewelry. He felt that I could demonstrate many behavioral principles in the context of his evolvement into the perfect husband. He thought I could discuss using a little non-contingent reinforcement initially, then changing that into contingent reinforcement, throwing in a little punishment when necessary, and even stimulus control, using my eyes to control that look, to control him when he's behaving inappropriately. But I decided against describing that life challenge. So I thought, what life challenge might be valuable for you to hear about? And I thought, well, perhaps my experience with breast cancer, which was a disease that I thought I would never get. Those of you who know me know that I'm a hypochondriac and know that I frequently have had imagined diseases, but I wasn't supposed to actually get any life-threatening disease. I ignorantly believed that since there was no history of breast cancer in my family, that I was protected. I didn't realize that 70% of persons with breast cancer, and yes, men can get breast cancer, have no familial history of the disease. I also thought I was too young to be diagnosed with this disease. I was 44, and I believed that breast cancer usually occurred in women past menopause. And while one's risk does indeed increase with age, increasing to a 1 in 8 chance over one's lifetime, breast cancer is by no means a cancer of the elderly. Statistically, there is only a 1% chance for a woman in her 40s to develop this disease. But as a behavior analyst who knows that the individual may not be representative of group averages, I shouldn't have been so nonchalant about breast cancer. In fact, I should have known that obviously one of the greatest risk factors is hormonal, as evidenced by the fact that while breast cancer does occur in men, it's rare. I didn't know that the longer women had menstrual cycles, especially before her first pregnancy, the more she's at risk. Thus, having your first period at a young age, having children later in life or not at all, or going into menopause at a late age increases a woman's chances of having breast cancer. Now, there are various explanations for why this occurs. Some theorists hypothesize that developing breast tissue, or that breast tissue between the time of one's first period until the time of one's first pregnancy, is more susceptible to carcinogens and thus to such factors as diet, alcohol consumption, or radiation exposure. Other theorists look at total number of menstrual cycles, especially prior to one's first pregnancy, as a predictor. Let me note, however, that Dr. Susan Love, one of the leading authorities on breast cancer, reports that encouraging early pregnancies would only prevent 17% of all breast cancer. But I was clearly ignorant of the significance of the hormonal influence on breast cancer. I'd had serious hormonal issues every month in terms of migraine headaches and PMS symptoms, which my friends and family can attest to. But I never thought that those issues might relate to breast cancer. I'd also thought that because I was not overweight, that I didn't need to worry about the fat intake in my diet. But correlational studies seem to suggest that dietary fat intake may be responsible for 27% of breast cancer. I hadn't worried about the donuts, potato chips, and ice cream, and the lack of 5 to 7 servings of fruits and vegetables a day, but I should have. I thought that since I didn't drink alcohol, was not on any hormonal replacement therapy, and hadn't been exposed to DES or a large amount of radiation, all of which correlate to some extent with the occurrence of breast cancer, that I was therefore not going to have this disease. As a behavior analyst, however, I should have known that certain setting events may make a behavior more influential than it previously was. For example, having hormonal issues such as a late first pregnancy or a hormonal imbalance may make diet more important. In any event, one morning in 1994, while I was taking a shower and doing a sort of breast exam, I felt a pea-sized lump in my left breast. Now, I'd had a lump a few years before, but that lump had disappeared when I started my period. As it turns out, many of us have lumps in our breasts that will often disappear when your period starts, and as I didn't know, those lumps are often aggravated by caffeine intake. Additionally, many women have fibrocystic or lumpy breasts, and that doesn't necessarily mean that those lumps are going to become malignant. But something, and this is not behavioral, made me think it was cancer. Being a behavior analyst, though, I thought I would use a reasonable, yet not overly intrusive, procedure that had worked in the past. I would wait for my period to see if the lump disappeared, as the other one had. It didn't. To me, the next reasonable procedure seemed to have was to have a mammogram. In fact, it had been a year and a half since I'd had one, but the mammogram didn't show any evidence of a tumor. And while I definitely encourage women over 40 to have mammograms, I didn't know that false negatives on mammograms may occur in premenopausal women because these women often have breast dense tissue, which makes it difficult for a tumor to be seen on a mammogram. Now, at this point, I was trying not to become overly concerned, which I usually have a tendency to do. But I did remember the advice of a close friend who had also been my gynecologist when I'd had the previous lump. She told me that if a lump appeared and did not disappear with my period, I should have it biopsied immediately. So I called my internist to have him examine the lump. Interestingly, he'd examined the lump examined my breast 2 months before and hadn't found any lumps. I didn't realize, though, that while many breast cancers are very slow growing, very aggressive tumors can grow up to 2 centimeters in 9 months. When he felt the lump, he said he didn't think it felt like cancer. The lump appeared to be movable, whereas malignant tumors are often attached to the surrounding breast tissue and are not easily movable. He said he truly didn't feel this was breast cancer and that I shouldn't worry. But a lump isn't normal, and as a behavior analyst, I knew that to most easily eliminate an undesirable behavior or condition, one should intervene as soon as possible. So I said that I would worry. He immediately contacted a surgeon in order to have the lump biopsy. When I saw her, she attempted to aspirate the lump to determine if it was perhaps a cyst with fluid in it. She was unable to obtain any fluid. She said that while this was not a good sign, she also didn't believe it was malignant. She had felt numerous breast tumors or numerous breast lumps that were cancer, and this one didn't feel like breast cancer. She, however, agreed with me that we should biopsy it. 4 days later, while I was under general anesthetic, she removed the lump. It turned out to be a very aggressive form of breast cancer. And when I was lamenting about this to Barbara Edsel, she turned to me and she said, "Jan, with your personality, why do you think you'd have anything inside of you that wasn't aggressive?" Well, after getting over the initial shock, I used the skills that we'd been taught as scientists. I wanted as much information as I could obtain. And with the help of wonderful family members and friends, I was able to obtain that information. I immediately went to a leading breast cancer oncologist at the University of Kansas Medical Center. As a behavior analyst, I believe it's important to be treated by someone who's actively doing research in the area. Carol Fabian, my oncologist, had received several grants and was running clinical trials on breast cancer treatment. She had the most up-to-date information. We now know that with cancer, it's important to make informed decisions early at the time of diagnosis. Dr. Fabian recommended a bilateral mastectomy. While evidence indicates that lumpectomies are often as effective as mastectomies with small tumors, I had a form of breast cancer that often appears in the other breast. That's the recommendation for a bilateral mastectomy. After the mastectomy, she also recommended a very aggressive and high-dose form of chemotherapy, followed by radiation. We also now know that breast cancer has a tendency to spread to other parts of the body. Thus, we need to treat breast cancer as a potentially systemic disease, not just a localized disease of the breast. Throughout the entire treatment process, I found comfort in using my research and analytical skills. I often felt strongest when I was doing something I'd been taught to do, like reading studies on the various treatments or graphing my blood counts. I have to admit that I was the only patient at the cancer center who every 3 weeks when I came in for a treatment brought my graphs of my white and red blood counts. I wanted to be an active participant in my treatment. It helped me give me a feeling of control at a time when I didn't think I had much control. I feel fortunate to have had and still have a very competent and understanding oncologist who took an aggressive treatment approach. I feel extremely blessed to have such loving family and caring and supportive friends. My goal today is not to alarm you, but to inform you. You should know that with each day, great strides are being made in the diagnosis and treatment of breast cancer. Just last week, at one of the largest cancer conferences, data was presented on a promising new form of treatment for certain forms of breast cancer, a treatment that attacks the genetic makeup of the cancer cell without destroying good cells, and that's without the side effects of hair loss or lower blood counts. Similar to behavior analysts in the field of our inquiry, researchers in the field of breast cancer are developing and evaluating interventions and translating that research into effective treatment. So every day we get a step closer to a cure and perhaps even a prevention. As behavior analysts and as women, we can celebrate that and look optimistically to the future. Thank you. Sydney Yerushalmi is next.
I think that I'm probably the only one on the panel who's not an academician. I also had the opportunity that I passed up that was brought to me very strongly when I read Judy's memorial to Ellen Reese in JABA to become a behavior analyst many, many years before I did. My first psychology professor was Thomas Reese, and he showed in his class pictures of his wife, Ellen Reese, doing very strange things with dogs and pigeons. I wasn't interested in dogs and pigeons, and because I was 18 and thought I was a humanist, my first response was, "And you can't do that to people." So I became a drama major. Anyway, many, many years later, when I was in a master's degree program at Northeastern University in a special education master's degree program, I was first exposed to the technology of behavior analysis working with a developmentally disabled population, and it totally blew me away. The power of an M&M. You didn't have to ask why. You didn't have to ask what. You just had to say, what is the old military thing? How high? When you say jump, how high? And there it was. And I thought, this is great. Why didn't anybody know about this before? Why didn't anybody tell me about this before? And it was years later, when I met Ellen Reese at a conference, that we had an opportunity to discuss it. I then began to teach at different universities. I taught teachers, and none of the courses were behavioral. When I was in my doctoral program, I remember having to correct the chair of the department several times in a course that he was teaching to explain the difference to him between shaping and chaining, because people were sitting there going, and I would say, Al, can I explain that? I mean, this is like really nice, but can I explain that? I came to this thing gradually, and I envy my colleagues on the panel who've had the beauty of straight training all the way through in the field. I had to learn it in lumps by reading JABA, by listening to people, and by having what I call behavioral epiphanies from very kind people. Judy was one of them. I think one of the best pieces on classroom management that I ever read was written by Judy, and the most important thing that was in that she said was, stand up. And I was teaching teachers, and I said, stand up. And when I hope that there are a lot of teachers who've been in my classes who now stand up. A behavioral epiphany occurred when Jack Michael took time out of a busy conference to sit with me in a hallway for half an hour one day and explain stuff to me, stuff that I didn't get. Because when you start with an M&M and a developmentally disabled population, you tend to be a mechanistic behavioral person and not a radical behaviorist. And then you can't explain all those things that happen inside. I worked with a developmentally disabled population. I knew that the technology was powerful, but I still wasn't sure that you could do that to people. Who are the people? Us. Can you do that? Could I do that with a normal child? Could I expand these principles to a population that wasn't developmentally disabled? I now have what is probably mainly, it's a behavioral and clinical practice. I apply behavioral principles to a clinical practice. And I did that with a great deal of trepidation, because it says in JABA that what behavior analysis is the application of principles to socially significant problems. Well, are nervous ladies in Longwood socially significant? I don't know. I've thought about that, and I've struggled with it. And what I've decided is, yeah, because it costs us as a country a whole lot of money to treat the nervous ladies in Longwood, the people who have... Oh, and before I forget, I want to recommend a book to you called The Diseasing of America by Stanton Peale, and it's in the bookstore because I unpacked it on Thursday, and you really must read that. One of the things that I do in my clinical practice is I do a lot of examinations, clinical interviews, they call them, for disability. And I am exposed every day to every kind of victim. And everybody is a victim of something. And it's interesting, I've developed a very sort of strange escape behavior. When people who are like really, really depressed come in and talk to me, I have trouble staying awake. I mean, these people are telling me these awful stories about all these terrible things that are happening in their life, and I'm like, yeah. And I put my head down and my eyes are closing and I'm trying to take notes. Now, when people come in and they say, here's the thing that's happened to me and here's what I'm doing about it and I need a little help to get over a little hump, that's great. But when people come in and they say, oh, and you know, my life and my family and my parents, I have decided I am the meanest psychologist since Dr. Laura. And she's meaner than I am. She really is. But when people start telling me how sad everything is, I just want to... And you're not allowed to do this because, like, they take your license. I want to punish, you know, like hit them upside the head. And you really can't do that. And one of the things that I realized is that as a behavior analyst, we cannot be victims. Because can't nobody do me, I don't let them. That doesn't mean I don't try to get all the perks. You know, you can dine out on being a victim for a long time. Many, many meals you can dine out on being a victim. Oh, poor me. I remember another behavioral epiphany when I was talking to a very close friend who tends to keep me on track. And I was telling him about this terrible thing that was happening in my life. And I was going to be self-righteous. And I was going to show them. And I was going to do that. He looked at me and said, well, how would that be functional? Oh. So that brings me back to the other thing, which is it's so easy to see how other people are not applying behavioral principles in their lives, how other people are not looking at the function of their behaviors and talking about themselves as victims when in fact the things that they are doing are very, very functional. And then one day you wake up and you say, uh-oh, babe, what are you doing in your own life? I've had, you know, I can feel so sorry for myself, can't we all? I'm a single mom, I'm a single grandmother, I'm never going to be able to retire because I was waiting for the guy on the white horse to come and rescue me. I've been married twice, I'm not a one-trial learner. And I finally got to the point where I said, wait a minute, all this is not going, this is not functional behavior. And so every single time when I go, oh, how did this happen? I have to stop and think. When I do things, I do them for a reason, just like all of the people who come in and put me to sleep. You know, I want something, I don't want people to leave me, I don't want to be alone. I think that when Beth talked about retirement, I think one of the things that women fear more than anything, and I think that's because we've been trained, conditioned to fear it, is that we are going to be alone. I have a conditioned scene. It involves me on the streets of New York. I don't know how I got there, I don't know. With a shopping cart. With all my belongings in a shopping cart. Because my youngest child has said, Ben's going to put you in a home. That's my son. And I know that nothing is going to happen for me unless I make it happen. The stupid mistakes I make because I'm doing things that I think are functional and they're not. One of the things that I've realized is that a lot of the complaining I do is because I want people to fix stuff for me, and they can't. I can only fix it for myself. I think that has made me a better clinician because I understand what people want from me, even if I'm not going to give it to them. And I think the last thing I'd like to say, and the thing that matters the most to me, is that being a behavior analyst has made my life as a woman and a human being lawful. I know that there are rules to behavior. I can get up in the morning knowing that the behavior of the people around me is as lawful as the rules that govern the fact that the floor under my feet is solid. And I find that's a really comforting way to live. My world works And I'm going to keep it that way. Thank you.